I would say that the majority believe that this is not a global pandemic, that you can isolate it to certain regions.
Hello, welcome to episode 50 of the MedSet podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwa. And in this episode, I have James Hammitz, CEO of Istim Labs, a company helping clinicians detect, treat, and track neurological disorders, including, but not limited to, Alzheimer's. Prior to Istim Labs, James founded Neurable, a company focused on brain-computer interfaces. This groundbreaking technology empowered paralyzed individuals to navigate the world with newfound freedoms. Building on this success, James embarked on his latest venture, Istim Labs, aiming to solve a significant barrier in neurodegeneration with timely diagnosis. In this episode, we delve into the fascinating connection between stress, gene expression, and the subconscious mind. We explore how stress can impact our DNA and the role our brain plays in regulating stress levels, whilst uncovering the intriguing interplay between conscious and subconscious thoughts, and how negative imagery may trigger subconscious responses with potential implications for our health. Welcome to the show, James. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure having you on. So we'll start off with the topic of Alzheimer's, of course, which you are specializing. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's is a very prevalent disease around the world, unfortunately. But for the listeners today, what are the different types and or stages of this condition?
Yeah, so there are five different stages of this condition. And one of the challenges of Alzheimer's is that while we have identified these different stages, they will also come with varying degrees of certainty about whether or not this is Alzheimer's. So the first time that a patient comes in and makes a complaint, for example, sometimes that's not even considered a stage of the disease. In other cases, though, we create this category of patients called subjectively cognitively impaired patients, SCI, SCD, subjective cognitive decline. That's another term for this. And as the person progresses from stage to stage, these stages are defined by the symptoms that the patient is affected by. So you have memory impairment, you have the person losing some level of, you could say, faculty in some physical exercises as well. Maybe, you know, playing tennis, it's just not as easy for them. Communication is another one. Are they able to maintain their same level of social engagement with their community? And so when you're at like stage three, you have what's called mild dementia. MCI, mild cognitive impairment, is another word to describe that. But we still do not have a definitive diagnosis. We still do not have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Sometimes this will be referred to as MCI due to Alzheimer's, in which case Alzheimer's is suspected. But it really isn't until late stage where the patient is considered an Alzheimer's patient. That's the stage five, where they get their diagnosis.
So at what stage would you say that Alzheimer's gets to a point where it's perhaps not reversible or perhaps can't be mitigated so much? Ideally, you know, what stage do you want to catch it at so you can actually start taking action towards it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So I think something that I probably should have said in my last answer to your question, you're asking me what is the best stage to intervene. The time frame of going between subjective cognitive impairment to, for example, mild cognitive impairment can be 5 to 10 years. So we're talking about a very slow moving disease. From start to finish, this can be a 20-year process. So in my opinion, at the subjective cognitive impairment stage, the subjective cognitive decline stage, stage one, that's when the preventative measures are the most likely to be successful. And that's when the quality of life of the patient is most likely to be protected in a meaningful way. One of the things that is important to talk about for neurodegenerative conditions is that even if you had a magic pill, and you took the magic pill and it stopped the disease in its tracks, there is no such thing as reversal. Once you have brain damage and the brain damage has affected your ability to perform in life, communicating, remembering things, your neurons are physically gone, they're atrophied. they're not going to grow back thanks to that magic pill. And so I believe that not only is therapy most effective at the early stages when the causes of the disease are minor, right? Just like a tumor, the tumor might be small, it's easier to work with. But the person's, you know, permanent experience, the permanent damage of the disease is also minor. And so if you were to treat at that stage, the patient can now live a life that is almost symptom free. Versus if you treat later, it's a lot more difficult to get the results you're looking for. There are more complications with the therapies. And even if you are successful in therapy, the effects are permanent.
So following on from that, there's often sometimes a genetic component to your risk of Alzheimer's. What can be done to perhaps detect your genetic risk when it comes to this and possibly mitigate those risks early on?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So I am not a physician. It's important that I say that. It's important that I say this is not medical advice. That said, the genetic factor is it's there, but it's not a very strong effect on whether or not you get the disease. The percentages will change from publication to publication. The percentages that I'm familiar with are something like a 30% increase of likelihood that you get the disease if you have the genetic factors. You can find out if you have those genetic factors by consulting your medical history. And by that, I mean, you know, the medical history of your family members as well. The genes, of course, are hereditary. So do you have a grandfather or a grandmother who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Do you have a history of dementia in the family? You know, there's a relationship between Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. And so if you have something like, you know, Parkinson's in your family, that could be worth investigating that genetic risk. So looking at your family history does help you with understanding that risk. But in order to actually know for sure that you have the genes, then you are going to want to do something like a blood test, a blood draw. Another thing that can be helpful is to do something like a PET scan or a spinal tap. The PET scan won't tell you about the genetic factors, but the spinal tap, I believe, can, depending on what type of assays are done with the procedure.
So on the topic of Alzheimer's around the world globally, and especially outside the US, are you finding that there's certain parts of the world where Alzheimer's is a bit more prevalent than others? Or would you say this is a global pandemic?
That's a really good question. There are scientists and doctors on both sides of the equation. I would say that the majority believe that this is not a global pandemic, that you can isolate it to certain regions. For example, in countries like Japan and Scandinavia, Scandinavia being, you know, a group of countries, Alzheimer's is quite high. In the US as well, Alzheimer's is quite high. But in countries, and this one is very interesting, in countries in the Mediterranean area of the world, it's interesting to see that the Alzheimer's prevalence is in fact lower than what we would expect given, you know, what we're seeing in these other countries. That's the whole explanation and inspiration behind the Mediterranean diet. Having more olives and oils in the diet, eating less sugars. Most of this way of thinking came from that observation of what are they doing differently in the Mediterranean to have such low levels of Alzheimer's disease.
So the topic you touched on, of course, is diet. Diet and exercise, of course, if you do a lot of exercise and you maintain a healthy diet, can obviously reduce your risk for many diseases. But what else would you say in terms of lifestyle changes can be done to perhaps mitigate your risk when it comes to this disease?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So earlier we talked about the genetic effect. And another effect that's worth looking at is insomnia. Not just insomnia, but also social isolation. People who don't spend a lot of time engaging with others, there's a very strong correlation between that and Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are some interesting theories. Does that mean that isolation causes an acceleration of the disease? Does it increase the likelihood? Or is it possible that social isolation is a consequence of early stages of the disease? And that's in fact something that I'm investigating with my technology. I believe that any type of brain damage affects the visual cortex, which reduces someone's ability to engage in social communications and social activities. And so I think that Alzheimer's causes more social isolation. But that said, there's a very strong link between the two. It's possible that it's both. It's possible that Alzheimer's makes it less likely to engage socially and that that activity accelerates Alzheimer's. But another thing along the metabolic track, which is something you touched on with diet, is the sleep side of things. One thing that I saw, which was stunning to me, was that if you have 6 or fewer hours of sleep a night, your risk of Alzheimer's disease can increase by 200 or 300%. You can become 3 times as likely to get Alzheimer's if you routinely skip sleep.
That's an interesting point because, of course, when I have a few sleepless nights, I can immediately feel the cognitive effect of that. You know, I can't focus properly, and I can only imagine the damage something like that is doing the long run. So it's very interesting that you touched on that.
And yeah, talking about I don't know about sleep, you, but for me, I physically feel pain in my head when I don't get enough sleep. That can't be a good thing.
Being a founder and CEO of your company, of course, you probably had many sleepless nights and probably experienced those symptoms. And, of course, doing something like that is very challenging and rewarding at the same time. So how exactly did you end up in the position that you're in today?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I didn't know that we were going that way. It sounded like there might be two questions that were going to come up. That's what I meant. But so my parents are both physicians. And as a result, I love building technology for doctors and for patients. I believe that if you create good technology for doctors, that's the best way to help patients. And so that's always been an inspiration for me in guiding how I develop things. Ultimately, I started off with reading a book about people who are bedlocked, who are stuck in bed because they are quadriplegic, paraplegic, and wondering what is it to have that type of life. And to read these stories, these biographies and autobiographies, very beautiful books about people who are typing, you know, in the case of the autobiography, they are typing their book by blinking their eye while someone is showing a letter card in front of them. And to me, that seems like such a reduced form of existence. And it made me think of ways that we can help those types of people. So I started off by building a company called Neurable, which I built while I was in college, which allowed people to move even if they were physically paralyzed like that. And the movement was enabled by brain activity. So the person wants to move left, their wheelchair can read their mind and figure out, okay, left is the way to go. So I was very proud of that accomplishment with building that company and that technology. And what that made me realize, though, and investigate, was why are people paralyzed? Why are they in that situation? And I found that there's a huge barrier to neurological care. So you can go to see a neurologist and you can complain that you're not functioning as you expect to be able to. You're noticing a change in your quality of life. And there is very little that they will do for you today. That doesn't mean that there aren't treatments available. What it means is that we are not doing enough to help this patient when their condition, in my belief, is preventable. And if we did effective prevention, then the patient would not need to be in the wheelchair. Statistics that I saw, and you know, there may be other sources as well, but statistics that I saw, at least for the American market, is that half of wheelchair users are there for neurological reasons. And as a result, I believe that since neurological causes are primarily, you know, these metabolic conditions, things that are in our control, I believe that that means half of people in wheelchairs today don't need to be there. And so I'm hoping that with my new company, with Vistam Labs, that we can address this issue and make sure that people get the help that they need so that they can live symptom free.
So you mentioned a few books there. Are there any particular authors or books that you would recommend for the listeners if they're interested in learning about what you was reading at that time?
Yeah, there's a very good French book. I believe that it's called Papillon something, butterfly. If I did a quick Google search, I know I would find it. But that was the most exciting book that I read because that was an autobiography, and it's about this person who is just, you know, imagining what his life would be like if he weren't in this bed. And one of the things that I appreciated about the book was that, you know, it's not told from a very depressing standpoint. You know, the person is still happy to be alive, grateful to be alive. If I remember correctly, it was a motorcycle accident that had that patient put there. So not exactly the situation that I can help with. But it was a very beautiful book. And it's important to know that, you know, patients are people and they have dreams, they have goals. That's why I want to help them. And I think anyone who reads this book is going to have a similar sense of we must do something. If you're very interested in this topic of, you know, agency and giving people freedom in their life, then, you know, the concept of paralysis, I believe, is an important one to talk about. And another context of paralysis, of course, is brain dead patients. One thing that's super fascinating and definitely a little bit outside of my field is that we are coming up with new technologies, not my business, but science. We are coming up with new technologies to revive patients out of the brain dead state that we didn't think was possible before. There are new brain stimulation protocols that exist where we have brain dead patients that normally we would just unplug with consent from the family members who were now able to wake up. And it's absolutely phenomenal. The part of that technology that I'm most familiar with, of course, is the brain activity. So for some of these brain stimulation devices, you'll look at the brain activity and you'll look for a specific signature in the brain. And that'll tell you that, yes, this technique will work to wake them up. But yeah, so these are the types of things that inspire me. And yeah, you can find plenty of resources online. There are lots of books about this. In the future, I think we're going to look back and say, wow, we could have saved a lot more people than we did.
So having studied and worked in the space in neurology, as you mentioned, with the reading that you've done in the past and the work that you're currently doing with your company, what have you learned about the human mind that you would perhaps say is not so much common knowledge?
Wow, that is a great question. What have I learned about the human mind that's not common knowledge? There are two things that come to mind for this. One of them is how much control we have over ourselves. And when I say over ourselves, I don't mean our behaviors. I mean how our body functions with our mind. So as the field of epigenetics becomes more prevalent and well-known and understood, one of the things that we're discovering, of course, is that stress activates and deactivates genes in our DNA. And so if you are a stressed person, then your DNA is going to be expressed differently for you because of that stress. What's very interesting about that is your brain controls stress levels. There's a very powerful, sympathetic nervous system, which is largely regulated by the subconscious mind. But that doesn't mean that your conscious mind doesn't have a role to play. You can consciously play negative images in your mind that trigger your subconscious mind that cause you to, for example, have a higher incidence of getting cancer. There are cases of cancer where it was mindset that changed it. Now, I'm not saying that holistic medicine is the answer, but I'm also not saying that just pharmaceutical solutions on their own are the answer either. I do believe holistic is everything, but I do believe that you have to take a patient's condition case by case, and that the way that they believe about their situation has a huge effect, the placebo effect of 30%. I think that that's explained largely by the brain's ability to regulate hormones in the body, which are linked to stress. If your brain is constantly sending adrenaline signals to your cells, and that's activating, you know, epigenetically certain genes, and those genes are causing your cells to die early or to become cancerous, that makes a lot of sense to me. I met a well-known neuroscientist. I forget his first name. His last name, Shadmir. His first name starts with R. And one of the things that he specializes in is spinal injuries. One of the very, very cool things is that there are people who have spinal injuries who are able to get out of spinal injuries just by working on their mental state alone. And it's not just, okay, it's telling yourself you're healthy, telling yourself that you'll recover. It's also constantly trying to move your toe, for example, while you are paralyzed. If you constantly do that, it's not well understood yet, but there are patients who have been able to, through that practice, of, you know, maybe it takes years, maybe it takes a long time, but they eventually do regrow the spinal nerves. They reattach and then they can move their toe again. I don't understand the process, and I don't think that there are many scientists who would claim to understand the process, but it's very clear that the brain learns from trial and error. And so if you try to move your toe and it doesn't work, your brain will adjust until it does. And part of that adjustment is, you know, creating new nerves. If you go to the gym and you work out, part of that process is building new nerves in your muscle tissue. Your brain is learning how to activate those new nerves as they're growing. So those are just a couple things that I wanted to share.
So what interesting projects are you currently working on in your company? Is that something that you're willing to discuss, or is that something we'll just have to wait and see?
Yeah, I like to share everything. I do have some secrets. I have some trade secrets, but, you know, I can tell you where they are in the scope. What I'm working on is a diagnostic for brain damage. And I think that today we have MRIs, we have PET scans, spinal taps. They're very great tools, but they're not tools that you can use for the patient who walks in the door. They're also not tools that provide all the answers that you need. A PET scan can be inconclusive. It only provides data in one dimension. It only provides, you know, protein levels of a certain kind. You can do multiple PET scans, but, you know, you can only measure one thing at a time because of the way the PET scan works. You drink a certain radioactive fluid. There is a new fluid that apparently allows you to do two, but it's not considered reliable for various reasons. The volumetric measurement side of it is harder to do. MRI is a technology I'm a very big fan of. And the reason I talk about MRI is because you are looking at brain tissue. The problem with the MRI is it is far from what I would say high resolution. And the reason I say high resolution is because it's an image and you can see a lot of information in it. But we're talking about neurons, which are very, very tiny, and you're not going to be able to see that, you know, one neuron maybe is acting in a way that's different from the nearby neurons with an MRI. An MRI also is, there are different types of MRI, but it's difficult to see how well the neurons are functioning in an MRI. And so one of the things that we aim to do with Vistam is we want to measure how the neuron pathways across the brain are functioning and how that function relates to the person's behavior. So what we've created is a unique protocol where you are watching our proprietary video, and this is where there's trade secret stuff, but you're watching our video and the video is challenging. When I say challenging, I don't mean for your conscious mind, I mean for your subconscious. Your brain has to work to figure out, you know, is this an object that I can see? Is it close to me? Is it far away? There are lots of little things that we do in this video that we originally created at Columbia University. And in this video, we are challenging different parts of your brain on purpose. And we're measuring your brain activity because we want to see, well, is the person functioning as normal? Because if we show a certain animation and the brain activity has deviated, then we know, you know, how many neurons did not activate that should have activated, how disparate is the activity, has the activity, you know, changed location of the brain that can be a sign of damage, is activity in certain regions lacking? These are some other things that we can look at. And what's really powerful is that with this technology, we are able to accurately predict things like your results on a PET scan, your results in a spinal tap, and even, you know, your results in MRI. We're still working on the last one. There's no publication on the last one. But so these are the types of things that we can do with our technology. And what makes me most excited is that this is not just Alzheimer's disease. This is all forms of brain damage. Most of the neurons in your brain have some role to play in visual processing, even if it's, you know, higher level of, okay, what do I do about this object? As a result, our method allows us to test a very large part of the brain and make sure that the neurons are communicating correctly. One thing that this gets me very excited about in particular is Parkinson's disease. We have not yet worked with any Parkinson's patients. Important that I remain transparent and honest about these things. But that said, it's an area of interest for us. And based on literature review that we've done, we do believe our method will work in Parkinson's. We also believe that our method will work very well with traumatic brain injuries. And this is only because there are other scientists doing similar methods to ours who have reported some early successes. So what I'm excited for is, I used to read sci-fi. In science fiction, you have patients lying in these medical beds on a spaceship. It does a whole body scan and it knows everything that's wrong with you, including in the future. Hey, you're going to develop cancer in 5 years. We are sort of doing that, but just for the brain. And that is our long-term vision as well. We would like to be able to identify these diseases before the person has their first symptom. If this could be a annual routine test where you walk in the door, you say hi to your doctor, you know, you go every year. Oh, we see the very first sign of Alzheimer's disease, and we can fix it with this regimen. That would be my future, the future that I would pick.
So interesting, you mentioned that you worked with Columbia University. Are there perhaps any institutions that you would recommend for the listeners that maybe want to go into higher education in neurology?
That's a very good question. I'm not a neurologist, and so I think it's important to, you know, if you have neurologists in your network, ask them. My opinion is that there are many top medical schools around the world. Oxford is a great one. John Hopkins in the U.S. is a great one. Of course, you know, you can also go to Harvard Medical School. You know, Mass General has a really good program as well. And I don't want to just be East Coast biased. I'm from the East Coast, but you know, California has some great programs. UCSD, for example, in particular, I really like UC Irvine, UC Davis, and not just on the coasts. You know, University of Utah. This is where in Utah was where BlackRock Neurotech was created, BlackRock Neurotech, and they pioneered the Utah Ray is what it's called, and that was one of the very first implanted electrode systems that you put inside of the brain in order to read brain activity. That was a huge innovation on the same magnitude as what Elon Musk is doing today with Neuralink. So there is a lot of innovation happening all around the world, even in Spain, even in Italy. I would say that France has a very good program too. I'm sorry, I don't have more specific advice than that. Oh, I guess I would say neuro is a very wide field. So try to figure out what aspect of neuro is interesting to you, because the different universities and the different hospitals, they're specialized in different ways. Some of neuro is intracranial, inside the brain. Some of neuro is outside of the brain, like what I'm doing with EEG. So there is there's quite a large field here. Stimulating the brain electrically and non-electrically, that is its own category of work and specialty.
If we forgot to go back in time and speak to the younger James, where would he think that he would be today? What were his original plans?
Wow. Well, I have to say that I continue to impress myself. And the reason that I say that is because younger me, you know, I knew that I was aspirational. I knew that I wanted to build great things. Reading science fiction books, I did think that maybe I could work on time travel or teleportation or something like this. Telekinesis was what I picked because it seemed the most simple of the three. So younger me would have liked to work on that, but also younger me didn't necessarily believe that those things were possible. I think that everything in life that we believe is impossible, it's just impossible until it's done for the first time. So I do like to pursue challenges that have a level of risk to them, a level of we don't really know. If it's not me, it's the next guy. And that's something that I keep with me today, that I'm not building Vistum for my own success. I'm building Vistum so that it's easier for people who suffer from dementia to get care. And if that means that I'm a big success story, that would make me happy. But if that means that the next company building on our ideas does even more, that makes me happy too. So it's not a personal ambition goal. But I do believe right now that I have achieved more than I could have imagined, just because I did not have the same level of awareness that I did as a kid. The technology that we're creating right now is quite sophisticated, and it's beyond my imagination that I had before. I did not believe that I would be able to create a part of, you know, this medical bed that I read about in science fiction. And I truly think that that's what will really help humanity and its health crises.
So with your diverse interests outside of work, when we've spoken in the past, you mentioned surfing and hip-hop dance. How do you find the balance between your personal life and, of course, the demands of being an entrepreneur?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a great question. If you are an aspiring entrepreneur, I heard this as a kid, and you're going to hear it from me too. It's that it's going to be very difficult for you to find balance, and it's going to be very difficult for you to, at times, not feel lonely. The entrepreneurship path is a solo journey. You can find co-founders, and that can be very helpful. But all that, just having co-founders doesn't make it just disappear as a problem. When you have co-founders, what that means is you have partners, people who are going to go in their own directions, but who are going to work with you. And as a result, sometimes it does feel quite lonely. And I think that actually pushes entrepreneurs to maybe be more creative and to pursue a wide variety of hobbies. Like, you know, I'm surfing, I'm painting, I'm playing piano. I'm doing these things because everyone needs a creative outlet. And I am, as an entrepreneur, just somebody who's exploring problems. It's what you focus on. And a lot of problems are problems you think about yourself. You engage others, right? You want to talk to the customers and you want to talk to advisors. You will have probably a larger network than most people. And as a result, maybe some of your relationships will be shallower. So my advice to aspiring entrepreneurs would be try to slow down. Know that you don't have to move as fast as you think you do. Take your time, because taking your time to do things the right way is better than going fast and failing in enormous ways. We always say in entrepreneurship, like, you know, move fast and break things. I think that was Facebook's original motto. And that's sort of true with go-to-market, but it's not true with strategy. And it's also not true in regard to what makes you human and what makes you happy. And one of the things that I've learned through my years of being an entrepreneur is that the happier you are, the more connected with your community you are, the more connected you are with yourself and what makes you happy, being able to, you know, go outside and sit in the sun and not do anything, just sit on a park bench, that will actually add to your success, because that's human. And you need to be human if you want to work with humans. At the end of the day, entrepreneurship is a lot about sales. You have to sell investors on your idea, team members on your idea, customers on your idea. And if you are a robot, you're going to fail. So, you know, take coffee breaks with people, eat lunch with your friends, go outside, play some volleyball. That will not only help you feel happier, but your happiness will increase your success.
Words of wisdom there, James. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. What one piece of advice would you be leaving the listeners with today?
Wow, that's a good one. Karandeep, I feel like I've left a lot of advice on the show already. But I do appreciate the question. I think the advice that I would give right now is, you know, if you are thinking about going into the healthcare space, if you are looking for collaborators and things of this nature, try to work with people who know the problem. And I don't just mean the clinicians. I mean the patients, too. It's very important that you are not thinking only about the money. And the reason that I say that is there is a lot of money in the medical space. It does draw a lot of attention. I mean, JP Morgan has this huge healthcare conference every year that most people in the industry know about. But medical technologies, it's a long road. So you really have to be in it for the right reasons. And the people who you work with have to be in it for the right reasons. Because if they're not, you could end up in situations where, you know, maybe you're working on a technology for a year, 2 years, and you lose interest. Maybe you're working with a partner and they want to be paid more and there's no budget for it. So you have to part ways. So make sure that you're ready for that, because the funding environment especially for diagnostic technologies, unfortunately for me, it is a little tougher because, you know, these investors, they're looking for quick returns, they're looking for quick exits, and, you know, they're not necessarily thinking the same way as you do. So be aware that it's a little harder to raise money in this space, but that if you do actually save people, if you do actually help patients, then you will be A-okay. So as long as you keep your values and your priorities in the right place, it's going to be just fine.
Thank you very much for your time, James.
Thank you so much. I've been really looking forward to this interview. I'm a big fan of the podcast. So to be on today is kind of like, wow, dreams come true.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to episode 50 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about James, you can connect with him online or visit his company website, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you'd like for me to have on the show in future, then feel free to reach out.